Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, Mike Keyes, Matt Curtis, and Tanya Forsythe join me. We're going to talk about the FCC and ISP privacy a bit more. We'll talk about the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation, going into effect next year in the EU as well. And Director Comey. Twitter account apparently unmasked. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about our newest Supreme Court justice and his record on online privacy, the new Protecting Data at the Border Act. In addition, we'll look at some devices as well, your smart TVs and fines and lawsuits against Vizio. Paralyzed man moves his arm using the power of thought for the first time ever, and no more garage door opener for one particularly grouchy customer. All this and much more on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 382, recorded April 7th, 2017. European or 12-year-old? Hi, folks. I'm Denise Howell, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. We're so glad that you're able to join us this week. We've got some great co-hosts joining me and a wonderful return guest, who is Tanya Forsythe. Hello, Tanya.
Hi. Nice to see everybody.
Great to see you again. Tanya is the co-chair of the Privacy and Data Security Group at Frankfurt, Kernit, Klein, and Seltz, and the editor of its blog, Focus on the Data. So it's wonderful to have you back on the show. We were talking before. It's been way too long.
Yes, absolutely. I'm thrilled to be back, and we've got lots to talk about.
We sure do. And joining us to have that discussion is my co-host, Mike Keyes. He is back from his travels. Wonderful to see you again, Mike.
I'm super excited to be back, Denise. Thank you, and look forward to today's show.
Me too. Mike, for those of you who haven't met him yet, is a partner at Dorsey & Whitney in Seattle and one of the contributors to its wonderful The TMCA blog. And my other co-host this week is Matt Curtis. Hello, Matt.
Hi. Nice to be on again, and I'm excited to have Tanya on and continue our discussion about all the changes.
I know, me too. Matt, if you didn't meet him last week, is a law student at Notre Dame and the host of A Pint of Law, a wonderful new legal podcast in its own right, focusing mostly on patent things, correct?
It's been patent so far. It's going to kind of be whatever comes across my docket, but it will be more IP related than anything else.
Great. Well, we've got a little bit of patent to talk about later on in the show. But at the top of the show here, we're going to get back into what we talked about at length on last week's show, which is the FCC, the FTC, states, and ISP privacy. All right. So the fallout from Congress's action to fail to let happen the FCC's privacy rules that were proposed and would have gone into effect this year, but they're not going to now, continues. We know for sure now that the rules will not go into effect because President Trump signed the congressional action, the joint resolution. I believe it was Monday of this week. So we know those rules won't be going into effect, and people are still trying to figure out what that means for them and what steps they can take to make sure that they're being treated by their ISPs as they would like to be, or in the way that they're exercising their rights to the extent that they can. Last week we started what we're going to continue on the show doing as our resource of the week, looking at various ISP privacy policies until we feel like we've gotten through all the ones that we can. Last week that we did AT&T, which I should have mentioned at the time, but really didn't do the further research until after the show. AT&T and DirecTV merged. And what I learned that means is if you are a DirecTV customer, your privacy policy and options are the same as AT&T's. They have unified those. So everything that we told you about AT&T last week and everything I put up on Facebook in our This Week in Law page there, I did a little follow-up post about various AT&T opt-outs. That also applies to DirecTV, which is nice that they have taken the confusion out of the merger process. We're going to talk about Time Warner, Charter, and Spectrum later on when we talk about our resource of the week. In contrast, that is a little bit more convoluted. But before we get to that, we want to talk about what happened here. Why don't we start with one of the things that we raised last week, one of the sort of fallback things that can happen in lieu of these rules going into effect is other rules can go into effect, for example, from various states. And one of the states that is taking action on that is Minnesota, which has tacked on some amendments to pending bills that would essentially, I mean, they're not verbatim word for word what the FCC wanted to do, but the crux of it is that they would require opt-in consent before things like browsing history could be shared or sold. We brought that up last week, and Matt made the really good point that there may be a federal preemption issue that the states might have to be concerned about here, and consumers hoping to have the protections of those state laws might have to be concerned about because Congress and the president have taken this action to make sure that the FCC rules didn't go into effect. So, Tanya, why don't you give us your thoughts on state actions in the wake of this here in Minnesota in particular, since we know what it is trying to do. And also let us know what you think about whether the federal steps that have taken place here may make those state actions moot.
Sure. So, you know, I do think it's been really interesting to watch the reaction of the media in general and consumers to what happened at the FCC. As a privacy lawyer, I see it through a somewhat different lens. And so, you know, the FCC rules were new. They had not taken effect yet, as you've noted. And they would have, in essence, imposed much more stringent protection or restriction on the ability of ISPs specifically, broadband providers, to collect, use, and share certain kinds of information in connection with online behavior in particular. Now, I think what's important to realize is that not only are we going to see states, and I think others, you know, try to put in place additional protection, the status quo was, even before and still is, that there are many existing state protections that control what ISPs and other companies can do with information. And remember that these FCC rules would not have governed companies like that were considered to be edge providers like Google, Facebook, Yahoo, any technology provider that also, as we all know, collects vast amounts of information about your surfing behavior, online analytics for targeted marketing. ISPs are certainly not the only companies that do that, but ISPs are already regulated by state law. So, for example, California's Online Privacy Protection Act, which has been around for a very long time, more than a decade. And that's the law that says you have to have a privacy policy in the first place. So all these great resources that you're making available, there's a good chance that those privacy policies wouldn't even be there in the first place if it weren't for CalOPA, which is part of the Business and Professions Code in California. And very importantly, an ISP cannot simply sell somebody's data unbeknownst to that person. Moreover, that's not really the business that they're in. So if an ISP wants to share data, which of course does happen either with a service provider or with a third party for marketing purposes or other purposes, all of that has to be disclosed by law under CalOPA. And you might say, well, it's, you know, California law, so who really cares? But it governs if there's any collection of data from California residents, which of course any ISP is going to be doing. California is going to get swept up, and so necessarily they're going to be bound by that. So it is a good idea to read those privacy policies. I know nobody does, but you should. And more importantly, you have choices, which you've been pointing out. There are opt-out mechanisms, both that are provided just as a matter of best practice by ISPs and other companies that collect information, but also through industry standards, the NAI and the DAA that I think we're going to talk more about that are that many companies participate in. And what really happens is not that your information is being sold, it's that your online surfing behavior as you go from one website to another, or more recently on different devices, even through apps, that's being tracked using usually things like IP addresses and device identification information. It is not in most cases going to be tied directly to, you know, your name and, say, for example, like a profile that a data broker might have on you. So it's not like all that then, you know, comes together and gets packaged up very nicely with a bow on it and presented for sale. Instead, it's you're being tracked in your surfing behavior, and advertisers can engage in bidding to target advertising to you as a kind of web surfer who has visited a lot of car sites or has visited a lot of, you know, clothing sites. And that's why we've all had the experience of using our Gmail to talk about how we're looking for a dress for an occasion. And then we go on Facebook and we're getting dress ads, right? That's happens all the time. That's targeted advertising. So if you don't want that to happen, there are opt-out mechanisms already available to you. It has to be disclosed to you that this is happening, and it is under existing law. And it is not only the ISPs who do it, of course, it's lots of other companies. So this is not a deprivation of rights that already existed. It is a maintenance of the status quo. And we can talk about it more. We don't have to spend time now, but because Europe is changing the laws, and I think we're going to talk about GDPR, many US companies are going to have to deal with much more stringent, even opt-in restrictions with that kind of information, regardless of this whole FCC thing. And so the practical impact on consumers is really minimal.
All right, let's unpack that a little. You brought up a couple of ways that you can exercise your express your preference to not receive targeted advertising tools that you've mentioned provided by the NAI and the DAA Ad Choices Program. How do those differ from the various things that the ISPs provide you when they say, okay, go here to opt out of CP, you know, our internal sharing of your CPNI, right. and go here to opt out of targeted advertising to you, whether it's by us or by a third party. How do those differ?
So usually if you look at a privacy policy of any significant size company, including an ISP, you're going to see a lot of different choices for how you can opt out of different kinds of collection, use, and sharing of your information. The tools that are provided by the NAI and the DAA are just a piece of that, and I'll try to explain. But so, for example, most companies are just going to say in a basic way, like, first, if you don't want to get emails from us, marketing emails, traditional marketing emails, here's how you opt out. Usually that involves sending them an email, or we're all familiar with what the opt-outs look like for CAN spam purposes. You get an email and at the bottom it has an unsubscribe link. And if you don't want to get emails from that company, or sometimes it's through a partner, it's spelled out clearly for you, again, under existing federal law, CAN spam, you can opt out. Similarly with text messaging, that's a whole other world under the TCPA that I'm not going to get into, but there are ways to opt out of text messaging.
Right.
Online tracking. Every provider of online tracking, well, I shouldn't say provider of online tracking. There are lots of companies out there that engage in online tracking for marketing or in some cases other kinds of analytic purposes. Even just Google Analytics is an example, right? Google Analytics, something everybody uses, almost everybody uses on their website just to sort of keep track of where their users have been on their website, what pages get the most traffic and clicks to help them improve their websites, right? And then there are more sophisticated kinds of programs that allow you to retarget, sometimes across websites. The NAI is the Network Advertising Initiative. It is a self-regulatory body that has participants from the advertising world. And what it means, what it has, is an opt-out. And if you look at many standard privacy policies, you will see reference sometimes specifically to the NAI, because best practice is also to include a link. So if you go to the NAI's website, for example, to understand what I'm talking about there, it has a place where you can click on the consumer opt-out to learn more about it. And there is a way to opt out of what they call interest-based advertising. You can manage your browser's opt-outs. You can learn more about mobile device opt-outs. And when you opt out using the NAI tool, it opts you out of interest-based advertising from, you know, the NAI membership, right? So any advertisers, any of those networks, et cetera, that are participating in NAI, which is most of the, you know, reputable ones. Now, importantly, opting out of interest-based advertising, retargeting, et cetera, doesn't mean you're not going to get ads. You're always going to get ads. And this is true whether you're using the opt-outs that are described in individual privacy policies that are sometimes maybe things that the individual company has come up with, or it may be specific to a particular tool like Google Analytics, right? Or if you use the NAI tool or the DAA tool, you're not going to be free of ads because the free internet is supported by ads. You are just going to get overwhelmed with lots of advertising about things you don't want, right? About Viagra and diet products and whatever else that you may not be interested in. So you can't just escape internet advertising, right? But you can use this tool and you see it there. And then the DAA Ad Choices Program similarly has members who, everyone's seen the little icon, the triangle with the little eye in it, where it'll be hovering over like an ad on a website, usually on significant publisher websites. And if you click on the icon, you can learn more about the advertising, what it is, and you also have the ability to opt out through ad choices. So again, there are a number of participants, and if you go to youradchoices.com, you will see a description. You'll see what that little icon looks like. You've all seen it before. You may not have realized what it is. This is the Digital Advertising Alliance. And that icon clues you into the fact that there is some targeted or interest-based advertising going on. You can click and learn more, and you can opt out through, you know, of advertising that comes. So you see the consumer choice page there. You can click and you can make choices about what you want to see. And I believe that you can be granular. Yes, you can. So this is going to look at your third-party cookies, and then you can be granular about your choices, or you can opt out more generally of everything. And again, you're still going to get ads. You're just not going to get what's called relevant or targeted or interest-based advertising. So some people think it's creepy, and certainly there are ways in which advertisers can cross a line and go from things that are really considered to be a benefit to a consumer to things that just creep people out. And I think these days more and more companies are trying to be less creepy in general, which is a good thing. The law does not technically require you not to be creepy, but most companies don't want to be creepy. It's a relationship matter. And it's bad for PR purposes as well. Now, I've heard some interviews with people in the technology trade press talking about how this isn't really, the FCC stuff isn't really about your just advertising and online advertising, that has more to do with a general rollback of your privacy rights and even related to things like your social security number, et cetera. That's not true. And I think people need to understand that, because in addition, there are lots of state laws. For example, almost every state has restrictions on what can be done with your social security number. Your social security number is not one of those things that's getting swept up when you browse online. At least it shouldn't be. That is not something that advertisers care about. And so this is not a seismic shift in your privacy rights. It is all about targeted advertising. And like I said, we will see more regulation anyway when the GDPR kicks in.
So I have a follow-up on that relating to, if you exercise your rights to opt out through the industry tools that you mentioned and directly through your ISP, what that does as a practical matter to the value of selling your data or customers' data in general, if more and more people do this, because on the customer side, okay, you're not going to get targeted ads if you opt out, but on the value of your data side, does the fact that you're not going to get targeted ads mean that nobody wants your data? Because certainly you're anonymized, and we can talk about the effect of anonymizing your data and whether you can be found in a moment. But if your data, nonetheless, you're not getting ads, but that doesn't mean that some ad network doesn't want to know about you and all your neighbors and tendencies and trends that may apply to different geographic regions or different demographics. And so I think the data might continue to have value. And it's a different question to ask, if I'm not getting targeted ads, what are you still doing with my data? Do you know the answer to that question?
Well, it's not quite that straightforward, I think, because remember, when you say your to say what does that do to the value of my data, that presumes that somewhere out there is a singular profile about you that's been built up somehow and that exists in a vault and is being offered for sale. That is not, so it doesn't really work that way. It every company with whom you do business, either online or offline, is collecting your data in some fashion that has been described to you. Everything from if you have a webmail account to if you buy a house and the mortgage company collects information about you, to if you buy a car and there's certain information that's collected about you. Each of these companies is subject to a different set of regulation in this country, very sectoral, very not one single set of laws, but many different laws that dictate what they can or can't do with that data. So the car company, the car manufacturer, really the dealer who sold you the car, is subject to the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, which is federal law that governs financial institutions, but also any organization like a car dealer that's loaning, you know, that gives you a lease. That kind of financial information about your creditworthiness, about your even the fact that you're a customer that got a lease, all that kind of stuff is protected by Gramm-Leach-Bliley and cannot be sold to a third party for any purpose. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't data brokers out there. And even some of the traditional consumer reporting agencies, you know, we think of like Experian and Equifax, they have other parts of their business that essentially act as data brokers. And they do have collections of data that are used that are received from other companies in situations where it's lawful, where the particular company has disclosed that they're going to share with third parties for marketing purposes or whatever it may be, they may get that data and then use it for segmentation purposes. But let me be really clear. I mean, if you really wanted to take yourself out of that, there are many ways you could. You couldn't probably do it completely across the board, again, because of all the legacy data going back years and years and years, right? Especially for people today. I mean, we've been living in this digital economy for a very long time. And so it's hard to completely wipe yourself from the earth. But you could do a lot. You could go to every single company that you do business with, online, offline, and tell them, don't share my data in the ways that you're allowed to have a choice about. Even financial institutions, for example, are allowed to share for legal purposes, are allowed to share with their service providers, things like that. Mm-hmm. But not necessarily for third-party marketing purposes. You can say, hey, I don't want you sharing for third-party marketing purposes. Okay. You can go to every website you do business with and say, don't track me and don't send me emails and don't send me text messages, and exercise every option you have to opt out. In California, you have the right to ask any company that you have a relationship with online what they've shared about you in the last year with a third party for that third party's marketing purposes, and they have to tell you under the Shine the Light law. You could go through and do all of this. The real question is, what does it get you? Not a lot. Because, again, all it means is you're not going to get advertising. Also, you would really have to stop using social media and sharing the things that you share voluntarily about yourself, right? Because when you use social media and you share things publicly, assuming that your social media accounts are not privacy protected and that they're public, you're also dropping lots of information, little digital bits of information about yourself that can be used, by Twitter, by third parties who contract with social media organizations to do targeted advertising. So you would basically, you could go live in a shack in the mountains and never use the internet and never do anything. But you could remove yourself from a lot of online, marketing and your data, the value of your data. I mean, it doesn't really matter. Nobody's going to come after you because you decided that you don't want to participate in that. You don't become like the enemy of advertisers. You're just not part of those calculations and those analytics.
Right. But I guess what I was asking is, if enough people do it, the value of those analyzations and analytics goes down, right? I mean,
I don't know that it does. First of all, you'd be amazed. Almost nobody does that. And people know about it. Like, I mean, this is not secret information. It's anyone who wants to know about this can find out. Most people don't do it. So the value of that information to advertisers does not go down. And I think even if a lot of people did it, I don't think that's going to stop advertisers from wanting to do online behavioral advertising for the populations that they can. So I don't think the value of the data as a whole, the aggregate data sets, goes down just because a lot of people decide they don't want to be part of it. And I think you could look at Europe, where, people have already much stronger, fundamental privacy rights under existing European law. And I don't think the fact that European data subjects have the right to say, not just take me out of tracking, but delete my data, take me out of your systems altogether. I don't think that's had the impact of advertisers not being interested in data sets for online advertising.
Mm-hmm. I guess the reason I bring this up is because one of the things I learned in plowing through AT&T/DirecTV's documentation is that if you do exercise your right to opt out of targeted advertising through that ISP, they will prevent your anonymous information from being included in aggregate reports about the success of ISP advertising that they're giving to their partners. So for someone who doesn't want their data shared, that's actually, even if it's anonymized, that's actually an effective step to take if you're an AT&T DirecTV customer. Mike, what do you think of all this?
Yeah, so Tanya, I had a couple of questions in terms of the state statute that you had referenced in California. So that I assume that only applies to ISPs that are providing internet service to California residents. Is that right?
Well, it depends which law we're talking about. But so the California Online Privacy Protection Act applies to any operator of an online service that is even collecting information online from a California resident. They don't actually have to have a contractual relationship. So even if any website that happens to collect information from somebody who's surfing there, who's from California, is covered by California's Online Privacy Protection Act. I highly doubt there's any ISP, significant one, that isn't covered by that law. So that's number one. And it means they have to have the privacy policy where they disclose these things and they provide the choices and all that. Number two is what I mentioned, the Shine the Light law. That one gets triggered if a company has a relationship with a California customer, but a relationship is, you know, as simple as could be, obviously, if somebody is actually using the ISP, right, it's their ISP, that's enough, that's a relationship. So certainly any ISP that has any California customers, even one, right, if that person asks for who their information has been disclosed to over the last year by the ISP for that third party's direct marketing purposes, they're entitled to that information unless they were given a choice not to have that information shared in the first place, in which case then they don't have to be told, but they either have a choice or they can find out who the information went to. That's a right that only belongs to California residents. You can only make that kind of a request if you're a California resident.
Right, and you see this when you start digging into the privacy documentation of these companies. They will have a separate link for California residents to go in and here's who, uh-huh. It's usually you need to send an email and request that information.
Yes, and very few people. It's amazing to me, actually, how few people use that law. It's been around for a very long time.
So are there other state regulatory regimes in other states that are similar to California, or is it kind of a pioneer in this regard?
That particular law is unique. The Shine the Light law, I believe, is unique. I don't know that there's another one like that. However, for purposes of the online privacy disclosures, the privacy policy, because the reason why you don't see other states with that law is because California basically effectively made it a federal law. Because again, if you're any website collecting information from California consumers, there are very, very few California website or any website that don't, because you can't know that you're not going to be collecting from California if you have a website. You just can't know that you're, unless you were like geofencing them, which no one does. You are covered by that law. And so no other state has to have a law that says you need a privacy policy because it's already there. Plus you have the FTC, which we haven't talked about a lot yet, but you have the Federal Trade Commission, which with a few exceptions also acts as the privacy cop requiring those disclosures and that companies don't engage in deceptive, misleading, or unfair practices with respect to collection, use, and sharing of people's information.
I wanted to mention the pledge that internet providers have signed onto. This is voluntary. They're not required to comply with it, but it's one of the steps they take to help stave off, hopefully, from their perspective, further regulation of their activities. The pledge that they have signed requires consumers to give opt-in consent before their what is listed here as their most sensitive information, I guess, in the estimation of the ISPs, which is anything financially related, health related, or related to children. So that would not include web browsing history unless it covered those topics, I guess. Although I don't know that it would cut that finely, that the ISP would be able to determine, you know, would be able to pierce through someone's browsing history and say, okay, we can sell this part because you weren't surfing your bank, you weren't doing online banking, but we'll be able to sell this other part because it's not part of these sensitive areas that we're required to get your opt-in consent to. Is there anything else that they've voluntarily agreed to require opt-in consent for, Tanya, that you know of?
I'm not looking at the specific pledge that you have in front of you that you're looking at, but
right. I'll tell you what it's called. I'll tell everyone what it's called. It was in January of this year. It is a press release that was issued. It's at the NECA.org site, whatever that may be, protecting consumer privacy online. Today, associations representing virtually all of the U.S. internet service providers filed a petition. We talked about that petition last week. And I guess it's the CTIA must have organized this pledge of ISP privacy principles.
So the question had to do with opt-in, and let me put it this way. Not only are there some voluntary things that you've mentioned here, there's actually some areas of federal law that require it. So, for example, you mentioned kids. The Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA, which has also been around for a long time, requires verifiable parental consent, that's an opt-in, before a child's information, child under 13, can be collected at all online, anything at all. And that actually is very broadly defined. So it's not just somebody's name and email or that kind of thing. It's also even IP addresses, device information. You cannot track children online for marketing purposes. There are very narrow exceptions that allow websites to do operational things for COPPA purposes. But if you are either directed to children or you are collecting and you know that you're collecting information from children under 13, you get wrapped up in this, right? So even for general purpose sites, and one example is that Yelp got in trouble several years ago with the FTC because they didn't have an effective age screen. So that's why you have age screens on some websites. But it's not good enough to just say, oh, you got to be 13 to be on this website, because that just cues the kid to say, I'm 13, of course. It's not really effective age screen. You have to have something that requires them to enter an age that's of a certain age, and then they can't back button. You actually can use a cookie to prevent them from back buttoning to come back in and try again. And so you have an age screen. If you are actually collecting the information from under 13, you need the verifiable parental consent. There was just a New York Attorney General settlement just announced yesterday with actually Trustee, which is a privacy seal organization that many people have probably heard of. Trustee is one of the Children's Safe Harbor or COPPA Safe Harbor organizations that can help you deal with the parental consent issue. And they actually just had to enter into a settlement for allegedly not having handled that appropriately. So not only is the FTC all over that for COPPA, it's also the states that enforce it. And there were fines and penalties involved. And COPPA is an area where privacy regulators get very aggressive with fees. So even the law itself says you got to have opt-in for kids. And yes, I think it is standard practice and best practice that those ISPs and others, not just ISPs, have agreed that they're not going to use sensitive information. Also, per the FTC's guidelines, you're not going to track people based on highly sensitive things related to health, financial, other protected characteristics.
Right. I guess it's... one thing that's disturbing to people in the wake of the joint resolution that did away with the FCC rules is that it's the ISPs and the FTC who are deciding what sensitive information is. It's not the consumers. So you may be sensitive about certain information that you think that, you know, as the FCC rules would have done, you'd like to have given opt-in consent for, but instead you can be opted in by default and have to go dig through those policies and find the industry organizations and opt yourself out if you want to.
Right. And I'll just mention that is an area where the European regulation will have an impact, because European also has very specific, highly sensitive categories all the kinds of things we were just talking about, and right. prohibits lots of, you know, requires opt-in for those kinds of things.
Right. We'll get to that in just a minute here. First, we'll put our first MCLE passphrase into the show. We put these phrases in case you are a lawyer or another professional who likes to watch or listen to the show for professional credit in your field. Some jurisdictions like to have you demonstrate that you actually watched or listened and didn't just write down episode 382 of This Week in Law on a list somewhere. So there was a term you mentioned, Tanya, that I'll have you define after I give our phrase here. Our phrase is going to be pigs in interspace. And you were talking about interspace advertising, I believe it was. Why don't you tell us exactly what that means?
Did I say interspace? I don't know. That may have been a misspeaking.
I think you did when you were talking about being tracked across devices.
Oh, cross device yeah. tracking? So there's cross-device tracking. That may have been what I said. Online, so there's all kinds of buzzwords. Oh, interest-based. Interest-based advertising. That's what it is, right? So in other words, when your advertising is based presumably on what you're interested in based on your surfing behavior and what you're looking at across devices as well, now that we all use multiple devices, so it's not just our browser anymore. It's also...
okay, I misheard you. And our phrase will now be pigs in interest based, which doesn't make any sense at all, but that is going to be
that works.
And just because we're getting a little silly here and yet still want to stay on topic, let's talk about Director Comey, shall we, and his Twitter account, because I think it's super relevant, actually, to what we've been discussing, how anonymous are you online and how anonymous is the data that you're putting out. This is not a perfect match to what we're talking about. You know, this is not that he was identified from his browser history, but he was identified when he thought he had, we think. I mean, there's no, the Director Comey and the FBI have not come out and said, oh, yep, you got us. That was Director Comey's Twitter account. But apparently he was giving a talk and dropped some hints that he had to be a savvy FBI director. He was actually using Twitter and using Instagram, and that this was a fairly recent thing, and that he had anonymous accounts and was learning some things through having these anonymous accounts. He let slip that one of those accounts had, he let the particular number of followers he had, which was, I believe, 9. I think that was his Instagram account. Anyway, if you want the whole sort of Sherlock Holmesian saga of this, go to Gizmodo and read Ashley Feinberg's sleuthing that she did, her account of her sleuthing. And the upshot is that it took her only 4 hours, and I'm sure others, you know, immediately when they got this information from the FBI director that he was on both Twitter and Instagram, we're trying as well. But Ashley got the prize, and you can go through all of her analysis and how she arrived at what appeared to be the Instagram accounts and Twitter accounts for our FBI director. And it wasn't... when you go through what she did, it's very commonsensical. I mean, it's not like she had to go all dark web and, you know, she was just determined and put two and two together in various ways. And based on who was following him and based on some, you know, knowing that his children were in the realm of people who were following him and his wife, and being able to extrapolate from there, it's pretty definitive that she found the account that, as she said, almost certainly was James Comey's. And that account is still an account that you have to have permission to follow. It's got a lot more followers now than it did before her article was published. And it actually published, it tweeted a response that you would only see if you were one of the people granted permission to follow that account, or if you were one of those people and screen capped it, which somebody did, and we can show you the tweet that went up. which was, you know, a meme saying, actually, I'm not even mad. That's amazing. And linking to FBI jobs, perhaps suggesting that Ashley's work there was so good that perhaps she should consider law enforcement. So I do think, various things can be pulled out and discussed about this. One, I think it's fascinating that the FBI director, of all people, you would think would be comfortable in the steps he was taking to preserve his anonymity online, and yet was not able to do so. And secondly, for others who are not the FBI director, it's a good cautionary tale that if you think you have an anonymous account, think again about, you know, what you're talking about and the things you let drop about it, because you could be found out pretty readily, as Ashley demonstrated. Tanya, what were your takeaways from this?
I thought it was an amazing story. I was just captivated by it when it came out. But I think it illustrates something that we talk about a lot in the privacy world, which is people want to share. And Comey shared. So it was because he had dropped little clues about it, and he was using it as a sort of interesting anecdote when he was making this presentation, that started the chain of events. You know, didn't obviously directly disclose it, but it gave enough information that you could follow the trail and put it together. And everyone in our world today, everybody wants to share. We want to go on social media. We want to talk about our interesting anecdotes in our lives and our families and silly things that happen to us. And every time we do that, we provide information that can be used to learn more about us, even things that we think we've taken steps to keep to ourselves. So even those of us who have private social media accounts but share a lot with those people, and your privacy settings are only as strong as the weakest link in that chain. And, you know, other people can do what they want with that information. So we make a conscious choice. Comey didn't have to talk about it. I think that the notion of having something be completely anonymous, I mean, that really is gone. So I don't believe privacy is gone. I'm not one of these people who thinks that privacy doesn't exist anymore. But I think the notion of true anonymity is a little misguided. And you see that again reflected, for example, in European law, where it is almost impossible to effectively anonymize data for European purposes. You can pseudonymize it, which is, I'm saying wrong, but there's actually a word for it to help de-identify, but you can't really fully, everything is personal information. Almost everything is personal information. Even a static IP address or a dynamic IP address is now found in Europe to be personally identifiable, which seems counterintuitive, not anonymous. And even here in the US, I'll tell you, I mean, when I counsel clients, and obviously this is not legal advice in any way, and I'll issue all the appropriate disclaimers, but I don't use the word anonymous ever. I don't believe in using the word anonymous in privacy policies. I don't believe in, you mentioned there was some company that talks about anonymized information. I don't believe you use that word anymore. You can say that we take steps to de-identify. You can talk about aggregate, but you better know how you're doing that, and your technical people better tell you how you do it, how you're doing that. Anonymous just isn't, you're never anonymous, never.
Right. Yeah, that's a good takeaway. Hey, Matt, did you think it was interesting that Director Comey was apparently revealed?
I think that one of the few things that we can agree in American politics today is that it's better when James Comey isn't on the news. So I was a little disappointed that they tracked him down. Even for him, I felt bad. I'd like to see him out of the news cycle a little bit more.
What about you, Mike?
I thought this article was just absolutely brilliant. I loved what she did here. I particularly loved how she made the link between Director Comey and his senior thesis on Reinhold Niebuhr. and then was able to link his username through that senior thesis from several decades ago. I thought it was a great piece, really good read. Highly recommend it to anybody that's interested. And I guess the only way to know for sure if this is his Twitter account, we're just going to have him on the show and ask him.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'll set up the email. We'll get right on that. Yeah. You never know. I've been surprised by who will come on the show, but I'm not holding my breath on that one. So we've been talking about the EU. Let's talk about a couple of things related to how their privacy laws may intersect with ours here in the U.S. You've been talking, Tanya, sort of around the perimeter here about the general data protection regulation that will go into effect in the EU next May. Can you tell us what that is and what we should be looking out for?
Yeah, sure. This is really a huge development, and it's something that is going to cause a lot of change here in this country as well. So the GDPR is a revamp of European privacy law. So the existing privacy law structure in Europe is what's known as the directive, data protection directive. The difference is that a directive is exactly that. It directs the individual member countries to issue their own laws, whereas a regulation is actual EU-wide law. So part of the goal here was to harmonize within Europe. Whether it will actually accomplish that goal is a good question, because there are still many European jurisdictions that deal with privacy much more strictly, like Germany, than other countries. But what it does, interestingly, is has an extraterritorial jurisdiction provision, lest any US company thinks that it need not worry about this. It says that even if you're not in Europe, you don't have personnel in Europe, you don't have servers in Europe, but you are processing the data of European data subjects, which is the term they use for people there. You're processing the personal data of data subjects, even if it's just they visited your US website, right? You are drawn into this. You are covered by it. And it does impose things like opt-in obligations in certain situations to use data in unexpected ways. So without getting too much into the weeds, you have to have a legal basis to process any data, personal data. And that would include things like browsing behavior that we've been talking about. And one basis to process the data is consent. Consent in Europe has a very different meaning than consent here in the States. We live in a, by default, fairly opt-out regime here, as we've been talking about. In Europe, it has to be a true opt-in, meaning you have a box that is not checked and you click it. For anyone who's familiar with all the browse wrap versus click wrap cases, think about it that way. Something that actually requires you to affirmatively agree, that's an opt-in. So you can process information when you have an opt-in, and it also has to be very conspicuously disclosed and explained what's going to happen. Now, there are exceptions where, for example, you're using the information for marketing that's contextual, right? Wouldn't be surprising, wouldn't shock a person, because I was visiting a certain website and then that company who I was interacting with is going to use my information to market to me a product I might have been looking for. That kind of thing isn't really, they can probably process your data for that purpose even without an opt-in. But if it's like, it's going to go to some third-party advertiser, the ISP is going to have this very complex relationship with all these third-party organizations for advertising, that would require more under GDPR. And so it will make a change even with respect to some of these things that we've been talking about with FCC, but it's going to make a change more broadly with respect to all processing of employee and consumer data when we're talking about EU data subjects.
Got it. So is it going to work like California's CalOPA has worked, where now everyone is going to have to comply for all of their customers with the directives of the GDPR?
Right. So I think that the practical impact is going to be that most companies that find that they are subject to it are going to have to make certain changes that, even if they're not technically required to comply across the board, are in many cases going to do that. So in other words, if you have to put in place certain mechanisms for consent, if you can really divide it up so that you're only doing that for people in Europe, I mean, maybe that might be done. But I don't think that in many cases it's not going to be that simple. And operationally, companies are going to need to do things a little bit more expansively. And remember, the GDPR is not just about getting consent. You have to update privacy policies to disclose these things. You have to update your internal policies about data handling and data security. You have to do, if the information involved is highly sensitive or in other situations, you have to do what's called a privacy impact assessment to make sure that, you know, you're handling everything properly. You have to do employee training. I mean, this goes way beyond just a notice law. There are, it's a total, for companies that don't have a privacy program, they're going to need to have a privacy program. For companies that have a privacy program, they're going to need to make sure that they have updated it to make it consistent with EU standards. This is a general movement towards a much more stringent structure that American companies are going to have a very hard time extricating themselves from. And I will tell you that the big technology companies, they are already working on this very significantly. Mm-hmm. They're investing a lot of resources to get ready for this. And smaller companies as well, right? But I can assure you that GDPR is probably a top priority for any company that has been focused on privacy issues and has very large volumes of consumer data. They're already working on this, even though we're still a year out.
Right.
So, Tanya, go ahead. So what are the penalties associated with noncompliance? Are they pretty severe?
They are. And that's actually the thing that's driving a lot of this attention. And that's why, thank you for reminding me. So the penalties are up to 4% of global turnover or 20 million euros. So that's a lot of money.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what occurs to me.
Would this apply? Sorry. Go ahead, Denise.
No, you finish up and then I'm sort of shifting gears.
So is this going to apply to any, I mean, even if you're a US-based company, you have no operations in Europe and you don't target any European customers, but you have European citizens that happen upon your website for one reason or another, this law would apply?
This law would apply with respect to your processing of the data of those European residents, unless you, for example, took affirmative steps to try to prevent that processing. In other words, you mentioned not targeting folks in Europe, and that could be one major thing that helps you avoid compliance. But to really avoid compliance, you'd have to basically say, do things again like geofencing, or affirmatively say you're not doing business with, you know, this is a product or service that's only available to people in the U.S., et cetera. You'd have to really make it clear that you don't want to touch Europe at all.
Mm. Wow. Fascinating.
Yeah.
So you brought up COPPA earlier, Tanya, and I'm wondering if we'll see similar fallout when the GDPR goes into effect as we saw with COPPA in the US when it did, which was, you mentioned some of the steps that companies have to take to make sure that people aren't faking their way or at least be able to demonstrate that they've taken steps to make sure that people aren't those under 13 aren't faking their way into using the site. So what the approach that companies take toward those under 13 in the United States is they simply don't exist for commercial purposes as far as the companies are concerned. We're not marketing to you. We're not directing our services to you. You're not allowed to use our services, and we're going to have steps in place so that we can demonstrate that we're trying to keep you off of our services. Are Europeans now going to be the new 12 and unders?
It is certainly having a significant, I think, impact I'm trying to find the right word. It's not emotional, but it's having a psychological impact on U.S. companies that realize that this is coming and they need to deal with it. And yeah, I think so. I think you can identify other areas where that's happened too. The Video Privacy Protection Act did the same thing, right? So because of the litigation that's happened with online streaming of video, and there were a handful of companies that got into trouble for allegedly not getting authorization to share, viewership information. So my personal information associated with my viewing behavior, you know, companies that wanted to share that even with analytics companies or marketing companies got in trouble, and there's statutory damages associated with it. So I think what you've seen happen is not that suddenly everybody has an authorization form up on their website. Instead, I think companies aren't doing it. I think companies aren't sharing the kind of information. It's just getting carved out. So it's just no longer a part of the business plan in a way that it might have otherwise been. And yeah, it is. It's a cultural change. And I think that it's going to help, actually, when companies are forced to start to jump through the GDPR hoops, it will have the practical effect of making them comply with a whole bunch of other existing best practices and laws in this country as well.
Well, that's good to know. I'm getting a little bit of feedback, Victor.
Yeah, I have a quick question.
Yeah, go for it.
So how much of your concern is that while this is beneficial to the consumer, in different than the FCC regulations on the ISP, we've got a lot of smaller startups that are going to have to deal with these compliance regulations, and the statutory damages seem pretty high. Is there any talk that you're hearing about making it easier for those companies? You're talking about Google spending a lot of money doing this. I know I have listeners in Stockholm for some reason. And I'm, practically I'm not able to deal with those hurdles. Is there any opt out for smaller, is there any lack of enforcement for smaller companies or anything?
Certain obligations aren't going to be as significant for smaller organizations. And as a general rule, remember that a lot of this is sort of risk-based, right? So one of the first things you do with GDPR is you look at your data flows. You know, what data do we have running through the organization? How sensitive is the data? How much of it? How big are we? You're not going to have to go through the kinds of contortions that a giant company will have to go through in order to make sure, even just to figure out if you're processing the data in a lawful manner. A smaller startup is not going to have the same issues as a much larger company. That being said, you know, I think obviously we're all familiar with a certain startup mentality, which is let's get away with as much as possible with respect to certain kinds of somewhat ambiguous legal issues, whether that be around things like intellectual property or privacy or whatever, until we're big enough that we can actually spend the money to do the right thing. I don't think that startups can just pretend that this doesn't exist and hope that they're going to get away with it, because I don't think that you won't be under any scrutiny just because you're smaller. I think the Federal Trade Commission has tried to make that point, as well as some of the state attorney generals, that just because you're a startup, you're not exempt from these rules. And we've seen some startups that actually have been put out of business because they've done things that, you know, push the envelope a little too far. But not everybody has the budget or the resources of a Facebook or a Google or a Snapchat, you know, on and on and on, to invest in avoiding doing everything possible to comply, or litigating, you know, or lobbying or whatever else you're going to do. So my advice to smaller companies is you can probably do what you need to do for GDPR at a much lower cost with less time involved, but it'll have the incidental benefit of, again, keeping you in compliance with, say, for example, the reasonable security rules here in the States for how you protect data. And that's good for you as a startup, because it's something that your customers care about, your consumer customers and your business customers. So I don't think that smaller companies should be scared that they can't make this happen. I think they can.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions on the GDPR before we move on?
So Tanya, does this give a private cause of action to European consumers, or is this more of a like an EU would have to start an action against a non-compliant company, or both?
It's complicated, but so first, the data protection authorities, the supervisory authorities in Europe and each of the countries have different names. They can take action, regulatory action. Individual data subjects have a lot of rights. So, for example, they can ask that their data be erased or that they can take it with them when they choose a new webmail provider, or, you know, that they have the right to be forgotten, which you've heard about. And if they have an issue, they can complain, and there are mechanisms for those complaints to be adjudicated. It's not quite the same as, you know, class action litigation the way we have here, because there's a different structure, and not all European countries support class action litigation or things like discovery the way we do here. But a data subject has the ability to, you know, start a complaint process. And even if you look, for example, at the Privacy Shield, which we're not talking about right now, but that's the data the new data transfer mechanism that replaced Safe Harbor. U.S. companies have to agree to participate in binding arbitration over some of those things that allow an EU resident to make essentially a direct complaint, and there are consequences associated with that. So there are a number of different ways in which a complaint could be brought to the attention of a regulator, who would then be the primary vehicle for enforcement.
It seems like that unless the company is big enough to have operations in Europe, you know, with substantial assets or employees or a presence there, from a practical standpoint, it seems like it would be difficult for the European Commission or whoever the body is that would be enforcing this to enforce this against a company that's really just a U.S.-based company with nothing over in Europe, right? Because wouldn't they have to technically – I mean, you could start, I guess, an action – before the EU Commission, but how are you going to go about ultimately enforcing that against a US-based company that has no operations over there?
Well, but remember that the hook for jurisdictional purposes is not a presence in Europe under this law. There's an actual provision in the GDPR that says that they can enforce the law over a company that is merely processing the data of EU data subjects. And, you know, I used to think sort of as a practical matter, well, same kind of thing you're saying, why would they go after companies that aren't really there? They're not going to have the resources to do that anyway. But actually, it's not true, because just imagine if you take one significant action against a company that does have a presence there, and you get that giant, you know, fine or penalty at 4% of global turnover or 20 million euros, you do a few of those, you got plenty of resources. And you can go after pretty much whoever you want. Now, do I think that there are U.S. companies that will challenge jurisdiction? Yeah. Mm-hmm. But it hasn't happened yet. And so I would say to a company, I wouldn't base your strategy around this on an assumption that you'll be able to defeat jurisdiction. I would do your best to show that you're at least engaged in the process of trying to comply, so that if a regulator does an audit or makes an inquiry, you can say, hey, this is what we're doing. We're doing the best we can. And remember that the U.S. government is not completely uninterested in demonstrating its ability to cooperate with the Europeans over privacy issues, because we did lose a major data transfer mechanism because of those that perceived inability of the U.S. to engage in appropriate privacy practices, and that has not gone away. If anything, it's gotten worse. The perception is that the U.S. does not protect people's privacy, and I think you will find, if you talk to folks at the FTC and Department of Commerce and other regulators here, that there is an interest in demonstrating that we really can uphold standards that are adequate for European purposes. And so even for GDPR purposes, I would expect to see some international cooperation, although, you know, that may be down the line. But I don't think that the U.S. is going to ignore this either. Mm.
Is there a decision out there that you're aware of, Tanya, that says that merely possessing the data of people located in a venue is sufficient to trigger jurisdiction?
Well, remember that this is brand new law, so we have no case law.
Yeah.
But it, you think of it as it's very similar in some ways to our traditional kind of minimum contact, purposeful availment type analysis. The argument, if you were a European regulator, would be that a U.S. company is purposefully availing themselves of the European market by offering products and services to Europeans, even if they're not there on the ground and don't have personnel there. It's a global economy. It's a digital economy. Maybe your website is in different language. Maybe you are very consciously targeting a campaign to people in another part of the world, or maybe you're just being very open about being global and you want everyone all over the world to be on your website. Are you purposefully availing yourself of that? So that's not exactly what the test will be, because that's our jurisdictional test and not European jurisdictional test. And I don't think we can predict how that will go, but I don't think we can look to U.S. case law to tell us how far the Europeans are going to be able to reach.
Right. Before we move on, Judge Gorsuch is going to become Supreme Court Justice Gorsuch. That was confirmed this morning. He will be on the court, and we'll look at a couple of his privacy-related decisions. But I just wanted to mention that Patterson and IRC has departed from the FTC's and the ISP's definition of what constitutes sensitive data. And to this particular consumer, his or her high score in Candy Crush is the thing that needs to be guarded. It can be a very subjective matter. And I would think the lower score would be more problematic, but moving on. Let's talk about...
I need to protect my bowling score.
Yes, I definitely don't want that disclosed. Let's talk about a couple of Gorsuch decisions. We've been talking about online privacy all day here today, and so it seems like a good time to just read the tea leaves as to how our new Supreme Court justice might treat those kinds of decisions. We have a couple of decisions from last year that sort of give you an inkling of his take on those kinds of issues. The first one was from last August from the Tenth Circuit, and it was called U.S. versus Ackerman. In that case, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children was conducting a search that was for emails sent to it by an ISP whose filter detected that child pornography was present in the email, but there was no warrant issued. Judge Gorsuch and his two colleagues on the Tenth Circuit decided a warrant needed to happen in that situation, and that it was a Fourth Amendment violation for the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children to go ahead and search the emails without a warrant. So that was the thrust of U.S. versus Ackerman. It's funny, he brings up trespass to chattels in that context, which is something that we come back to from time to time on the show, and generally relates to when, you know, we have cases in California where trespass to chattels has been applied to keep you from inundating a server in such a way that it impairs its operation, kind of like a DDoS idea. But I think he's using it differently. Quote from the case, "We are dealing instead with the warrantless opening and examination of presumptively private correspondence that could have contained much besides potential contraband for all anyone knew." And that seems pretty clearly to qualify as exactly the type of trespass to chattels that the framers sought to prevent when they adopted the Fourth Amendment. So getting into your constitutional scholarly pursuits here, I was unaware that trespass to chattels was one of the reasons why the Fourth Amendment was enacted. But I suppose that anything that's not property is, or, you know, real property is a chattel. And if something is being unreasonably searched and it is not your real property, it could be a trespass to chattels. And there's one more decision from last year that was called, let's see, let me pull that one up. U.S. versus Carlos or Carlos, there are two S's, so you tell me how to pronounce that, where Judge Gorsuch actually dissented from his colleagues who had found that police gained evidence and permission to search a person's real property despite the fact that there was a no trespassing sign, I think on the door and elsewhere, and that doing what's called a knock and talk, which is, you know, knocking on the door, engaging the homeowner in conversation and trying to get permission to search, that doing that in the presence of no trespassing signs was problematic to Judge Gorsuch. The court actually went the other way on the decision, but he dissented because he thought apparently that the officers should have walked away and gotten a warrant when they saw the no trespassing signs. Anybody want to add anything else on Judge Gorsuch and privacy or technology at all before we move on? Matt?
I'll put this one in the chat too, but there is a case, Meshworks versus Toyota Motor Sales, which he ruled on in a copyright basis of when you take a – they took a Toyota car and turned it into a 3D model. And I think ultimately came out it did not – create a copyright infringement. I thought it was a well-written and reasoned opinion, though. I'll make sure to put it up there.
Great. Thanks for that. Mike, anything?
Yeah, so interesting. You know, Gorsuch has been compared to Scalia in a lot of ways, Justice Scalia, whose seat he's taking. And, you know, these Fourth Amendment decisions by Gorsuch seem to be consistent with some of the cases that I remember Scalia decided under the Fourth Amendment. There was a big watershed case dealing with thermal imaging inside of somebody's house. Scalia wrote the majority opinion for that case, the Kylo case, saying that that was an unreasonable search. There was another case more recently where Scalia also found an unreasonable search when there was some tracking device that was attached to somebody's car or something. So, you know, it seems very much in the same mold as Scalia, these decisions that he's issued, at least as it pertains to the Fourth Amendment. Of course, they're both originalists in how they interpret the Constitution, which is you look to interpreting the Constitution as the framers understood it at the time of the drafting. So it's going to be really interesting to see. I've read a couple of his opinions. And you know they're a good read, much like Scalia's were. Even if you never agreed with them, they're fun, interesting tales.
Good. Tanya, any thoughts?
I actually completely agree with that. I think it's not surprising to see him following the Scalia model. And I was actually with the trespass issue thinking exactly of the, I believe it was the Jones case with the tracker and the car. And I think there was a discussion of trespass in that context as well. And so this does remind me a lot of Scalia. And in that way, not as surprising that Gorsuch would go there. And I think Scalia has been regarded, you know, whatever your opinion may be, I think there are many in the privacy community who feel he was he did a lot for privacy in Supreme Court jurisprudence.
All right. Well, Judge Gorsuch is now officially Justice Gorsuch. And from reports I heard this morning, could be on the bench and considering decisions before the end of this month. So there we go. Speaking of warrants, if this is something near and dear to your heart, you might want to get in touch with your elected representatives in the Washington arena, Congress or the Senate. There is a bill pending called the Protecting Data at the Border Act that is aimed at addressing a lot of hand-wringing over what Customs and Border Patrol agents can do at the border and the fact that they're seems over time to have developed this practice that they enjoy a Fourth Amendment exception for national security purposes where devices can be searched and evidence gathered even without a warrant. So this act would require a warrant for those searches. So if that's something that you are interested in or care about, you might want to look into the Protecting Data at the Border Act and contact your representatives about that. Have you heard of this, Tanya?
Yeah, obviously this is a controversial issue right now and is being kind of put back into the public consciousness by what's been going on at airports and new immigration policies and things like this. So, no, I do think it's interesting to see, you know, under immigration rules and at the border in general, there's a lot more leeway for things like searches. And so that it's fascinating to see this kind of legislation introduced. Whether it will ultimately happen, I think, is a question and a good one. But not surprising under the circumstances that we're seeing attention to whether there can be greater restriction. And I think that even business travelers are more concerned these days about what happens to their information when they're traveling internationally. Companies are trying to take steps to make sure that people aren't carrying a lot of sensitive information, not just personal information, but business confidential information when they cross borders.
Okay, well, we've been talking a lot about privacy in the ISP setting and whether or not you can keep an anonymous Twitter account and EU privacy and new border protection legislation pending possibly in the U.S. Let's continue on the privacy theme, but move over into the arena of devices and the Internet of Things. Tanya, you co-authored a really interesting article about smart TVs and best practices for those manufacturing similar devices. You and Daniel Goldberg wrote a piece called "Every Move You Make, I'll Be Watching You, Watching Me, Watching You," which I love as a title. Tell us what happened with Vizio.
Yeah, Vizio is a manufacturer of smart TVs and has gotten caught up in a number of regulatory action as well as some private class action litigation involving allegations that the devices are collecting are not being fully transparent. Sounds odd to say the devices are not being fully transparent. The bottom line is that there wasn't sufficient disclosure of the data collection, use, and sharing practices. And so recently there was a settlement with the FTC and New Jersey, I believe, with some fines and penalties. Importantly, they also had to delete a bunch of the data that was collected. And there is still pending a multi-district litigation, class action litigation that involves similar allegations. Now, it's interesting to note that, again, California, of all places, has legislation that took effect, I think, at the beginning of 2016 that actually prevents smart TVs specifically from collecting certain information without an opt-in when you set the thing up to click through when you set up the device. Now, I think it's interesting both because it's only smart TVs and not other connected devices, right? So it's a good example of how sometimes legislation is so particular, and here even technology specific, which I'm not sure makes a lot of sense, but and also state-based, only California. So strange that that would be the case, and that, for example, something like a cell or a Google Home device isn't necessarily subject to the same kinds of restrictions. And I do think that state regulators are looking at some of those other kinds of connected devices and trying to figure out if the disclosures are sufficient when, you know, they may be picking up through voice recognition, they may be picking up things that aren't meant to be collected. They may be picking up kids' information. They may be picking up all kinds of things. So we're really only beginning to scratch the surface of what it means to protect information in the IoT world.
Right. Isn't it Illinois that has some legislation pending? I don't think they've passed it yet, that are aimed at things with microphones that can passively record you in your house.
Yeah, that I don't know about the recording, but Illinois has the biometric information legislation that's in place that has also spawned a lot of litigation as well. And I want to say Texas, I may be getting that wrong, I think is the other state that has that. But biometric information is starting to get more attention. And the voice issues, I think, you'll see more of. There's been some other litigation. There was litigation a year or two ago involving the smart Barbie that was collecting voice information from kids. The Germans recently told people to, destroy a doll that was collecting information. It's not enough to just get rid of it. You got to burn it. The voice information is becoming more and more of a target as well.
Right. I just looked up what had prompted me to think of Illinois. The New York Times has a piece from March 26th by Connor Doherty about state privacy legislation aimed at devices. And Illinois apparently is considering a bill that would limit the use of microphones in internet connected devices like mobile phones, smart TVs, and personal assistants like the Echo. So I don't know how that gets enforced, that the mics have to be off unless turned on. Something like the Echo's functionality would have to change. They have a model where you have to push a button in order for it to listen to. Maybe in Illinois, that would be the only one you could sell there.
Yeah, I think it's a good question as to whether there should be some additional disclosure before. I think of it in the same way that I think of with your phone location tracking. So in the app platforms now have to do the push that says, this app wants to collect your location information. Are you okay with that? And I think also, honestly, for the microphone as well, I think people have probably seen where you get the push that says the app wants access to the microphone. Mm-hmm. I think similar to that. And you're right. I mean, when you plug in your Alexa, it doesn't say, all right, hi, I'm going to start collecting your voice information, by the way. But, you kind of think, well, that's what you're doing, right? I mean, there is a certain... well, what are you doing if it's not collecting my voice information? Of course it is.
Yeah. Anything to add, Mike or Matt?
Well, Denise, you may have also been thinking about Illinois because that's where I believe the class action suit was pending against WeVibe that was ultimately settled.
yes. The infamous WeVibe. I'm always thinking of Illinois. Speaking of which, Evan Brown's going to come back on the show soon on the 21st of April for all of you Evan fans out there. Okay. We can ask him more about Illinois legislation and things that are pending there. I'm not sure where in the world this happened. Hopefully I can glean it from the article. But a hysterical sort of pas de deux played out between a customer and a company called GarageIt, which is an internet connected garage door opener. The customer didn't care for the GarageIt or had a bad experience with it and left some don't waste your money kind of comments on Amazon, giving it a negative review. The company's response was to disable his device and tell him, you don't have to keep it, return it to Amazon for a refund, but your unit ID number, blah, 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 will be denied server connection. So, we're done with you. So I think this is just a telling harbinger of the world of connected devices. I mean, the PR fallout for having done this was bad, although as the company itself was happy to point out, Elon Musk tweeted, must be a slow news day if denying service to a super rude customer gets this much attention. It does give me pause that a company's recourse to a negative review would be, we're done with you. You don't have to be our customer. There isn't really a privacy ramification here, but from the standpoint of, how internet connected devices work and the fact that if you require the company's cooperation and a server connection for the device to work, you may find yourself on the wrong end of the company's ire if you do something that upsets the company. Any thoughts about this, Mike?
Yeah, so it takes self-help to kind of a new level, I suppose. When I first read it, I thought, oh boy, is this a violation of the Consumer Fairness Review Act, which you all may recall is a recent act that passed at the federal level that prohibits a company from contracting with a customer that prohibits the customer from leaving online reviews that are negative. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's a violation of the act because that applies to a contractual obligation that a company tries to assert against a consumer. It doesn't appear to prohibit self-help remedies like GarageIt exercised here.
Yeah, exactly. They had no contract saying you can't leave a negative review, but I guess they're telegraphing the message that if you do leave a negative review, you do so at your own risk. Anything to add, Tanya?
No, I think it's fascinating, though, entering the world of devices that talk back and take action.
Right. Exactly. Matt?
Just bad customer service. This falls into the don't be dumb category of last week.
Yes, absolutely. And then, Matt, you had flagged this piece, which I suppose we can talk about legal overtones to it, but I think it's just fascinating. Bill Kochevar, if I'm saying his name correctly, is the first person to have received, he was paralyzed below the neck, and he received electrical implants in the motor cortex of his brain and sensors into his forearm that despite his paralyzation, he also, as part of this process, went through virtual reality training of the system where he's hooked up to a computer and the computer would learn his brain waves. He was made to move a virtual arm on the screen with his brain waves so that the system could learn how his brain communicated to its muscles. I would like you to move that arm and pick up that thing. And it was able to take that information and actually put it into these sensors and this whole system so that what it learned through that process was able to work in the real world. And it's still very much a research project. This is not ready for prime time at this point. But they had success with it, and it's a really cool thing. And I guess the reason I bring it up on the show is moving further into our cyborg future and the fact that people and software are, will ultimately become one in ways like this. And what does that mean? We're talking about data security and hacking, hacking this guy's arm would obviously be a bad thing. Anything to add, Mike?
I just thought it was astounding. A really feel-good story, frankly, about, there really are no limits to what technology is going to bring us. And this fella, was tragically paralyzed and it's changed his life. And this kind of technology is going to just change, millions of people's lives. So it's really exciting.
Right. I guess, Tanya, from your perspective as a privacy lawyer, if you're actually able to put that targeted advertising into someone's brain and then have them carry out actions, that would be data that I'm sure the FTC and others would consider sensitive.
Yeah, I think that safely takes us into the creepy territory that we want to avoid.
I think so. Matt, anything to add? We'll try and get Matt back. Maybe now would be a good time for a little palate cleanser and all of the creepy and borderline creepy stories that we've been going over this week on This Week in Law. I will mention, too, if you're interested in delving deeper into anything that we've discussed, we do make our prep lists available in a couple of forms. We have a Flipboard magazine. If you find D. Howell user on Flipboard, you'll find the This Week in Law magazine. We'd love it if you want to contribute to that magazine. Give me a holler at denise@twit.tv, and I'm happy to send you an invite love to get ideas for show topics there. And also we do a public list of all the links in our rundown. That's at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. This is episode 382 if you're looking for the links from today's show. And one of those links is going to be our animal selfie of the week. This week's animal selfie is not just one animal selfie, but a whole collection of them, and just an indicator, I guess, that not just here on This Week in Law do we find it fascinating that animal selfies have become a part of our culture and the various legal ramifications that can flow from them, such as who owns the copyright to such things and what are animals' rights of publicity. Here there is a company called The Best Card Company, and they have a whole pack of animal selfie cards that you can procure for yourself if you, like us, are huge fans of this. All of them appear to be animal selfies in the pure sense, where the animals are taking the photos of themselves, and thus PETA might write in and say that they have some sort of copyright interest to assert. We have various monkeys and horses and dogs and kangaroos and lemurs and an owl and a frog, I think, on the owl's head and a butterfly next to the frog that are all being captured. I think these are perhaps more fanciful than actual. These might be illustrations and not actual photos. Certainly if they're photos, they look heavily Photoshopped, but they're really cute, and they are our animal selfie of the week. Our tip of the week is paying attention to language in these privacy policies and things that we've been discussing. And how to distill it into a soundbite of a tip might be: personal information may not be, quote unquote, personal information may not be what you think it is. And you should pay attention to how these terms are defined in documents. Certainly personal information can mean different things to different people in different regulatory agencies and different companies. In the particular case of your relationship with your ISP, I would assume that you'd want to know what that ISP defines personal information as. Particularly, our resource of the week last week was AT&T's privacy policy, and we led off by letting you know that front and center on the AT&T and DirecTV privacy policy, they have language now that says, "We will protect your privacy and keep your personal information," using that phrase, "safe. We use encryption and other security safeguards to protect customer data. We will not sell your personal information," using that term again, "to anyone for any purpose, period." But if you want to get all literal with them, when you delve into the privacy policy and look at their definitions, they define personal information as follows: information that directly identifies or reasonably can be used to figure out the identity of a customer or user, such as your name, address, phone number, and email address. So if you as a consumer were thinking, gee, that's so nice, AT&T tells me they're not going to sell my personal information, AT&T may be able to argue at some point that personal information doesn't mean de-identified aggregate information, or doesn't mean your web browsing history when presented in that kind of a form, but is limited to things that can be used to figure out the identity of a customer or user, because that's how they define it in their privacy policy. So the tip is pay attention to terms and know what your ISP and others mean when they're talking about personal information. It might not jibe with what your expectations are. Tanya, do you have anything to add to that?
I actually totally agree with that. I think you have to be very careful to understand what those definitions mean. But I would add that I think more and more it is more difficult today for a company to take the position that information is really not capable of being connected with an individual than it was before. I mean, most information can be re-identified, and the question is how much cost and how much effort would it take? And so when a company says that they still have the right to do things with aggregate or de-identified information, assuming that it's a company that has gotten itself some good, advice in connection with putting that privacy policy together, I would have a pretty decent level of comfort that that really means it's aggregate and it's de-identified in some fashion, meaning that while it might allow a marketing company to target segments of the population, like, you know, women in their 40s who like 80s music, right? It's not going to be more specific than that, such that they can actually find you, Tawny Forsythe. So I do agree people should read and pay attention to definitions, but also know that the definition of personal information is so broad now that most of the time that's going to cover a lot.
All right. We need a second MCLE passphrase. And given that we just lost Matt on Skype for a little bit and he's back, we're going to make it Matt's back. Hi, Matt. Welcome back.
Thanks. Sorry about that.
No worries. Our resource of the week, we'll have a follow-up first on last week's resource of the week, which was AT&T's privacy policy and its various opt-outs. As I said, after the show last week, I put some stuff on Facebook that will give you some further help, links to where you can opt out of various things. And the things you appear to be able to opt out of, sort of consistently with ISPs, are the company's internal sharing of your CPNI, which is customer proprietary network information. They usually have a form that you can fill out so that one arm of the company, the internet arm of the company, say if you're a cable television subscriber, isn't sending you mail about also becoming an internet subscriber, that sort of thing. So if you'd like to opt out of that, that's what CPNI is. It's internal though. Although I did find something interesting this week, we're doing Time Warner, Spectrum, and Charter, which have all merged and have merged in ways that make things I found to be super confusing for the consumer. It is really hard to know if you are a Time Warner customer that's now under the umbrella of Spectrum and Charter, which privacy policy might apply to you, because they haven't unified things very well, or really much at all. So Time Warner has its own privacy policy and notices. Charter has one on the web that dates back to 2009. I mean, it's on a spectrum.com website. And there's the added confusion in all of these that you might go to the bottom of the page and find yourself looking at a bunch of links that say things like privacy policy. And when you click on that, you're looking at the website's privacy policy and not the privacy policy that actually applies to you as a cable customer or an internet service customer or all of the above. Once again, I did a Facebook post that puts a couple of things together for you that will hopefully be helpful. There is one link in particular to opting out of, again, this is says Charter and Spectrum and doesn't say Time Warner Cable, but I'm assuming that if you're a Time Warner Cable customer that this applies to you too, where you can remove yourself from the email marketing list. You can remove yourself from marketing ads and remove yourself from receiving certain targeted television ads in one place. Of course, this all, it's on a Spectrum site and it, actually it's on a site that says pc2.mypreferences.com/charter/privacy. So you tell me if you're a Spectrum or Time Warner or Charter customer, if you're comfortable that these are actually going to apply to you. I hope that they do. And that is the link that you should go to remove yourself from those various data gathering mechanisms. But one thing that I found really interesting buried in the CPNI opt-out for Time Warner, Spectrum, Charter, is language talking about opting out of some information sharing that was not internal. Here's what they say. Unless you object, the Communications Act also permits us to disclose limited personally identifiable information to others, such as advertisers and direct mail companies, for non-cable related purposes, such as direct marketing. Under the Communications Act, these disclosures are limited to the following mailing list information: your name, address, and, except in California, the particular non-phone services to which you subscribe, e.g. HBO or other premium channels or tiers of service. In addition, we may add to this mailing list information commercially available information about you that is obtained from third parties, such as your age, income, and other demographic or marketing information. Mailing list information does not include the extent of your viewing or use of a particular service. We may disclose or sell such mailing list information from time to time. If you wish to be removed from our mailing list, please notify us in writing at our main local office, which will be noted on your cable bill, or by sending an email to twcprivacy@timewarnercable.com. Please include your name and address on any such request. I'm actually not real sure from reading through that. And we do have Tanya, who is an actual privacy lawyer, on the line, and maybe she'll have a better opinion. What you're able to opt out of by emailing twc.privacy@twcable.com, but it seems to relate to disclosing and selling mailing list information. But then they say if you just want to be removed from our mailing list. So maybe that's all you're able to get out of it. I am a Time Warner Cable customer, and just as a belt and suspenders approach, shot off an email and said, to the extent I can opt out of anything related to your sharing personally identifiable information about me with third parties, I am opting out. So, Tanya, any thoughts about the language I just read?
Well, without getting specific about commenting on any particular approach, I think you're seeing a lot of things reflected here. One is that different laws have certain requirements about different choices that consumers must be provided. And so you're seeing the choices with respect to the Federal Communications Act, and you're also seeing some carve-outs related to California. But the bottom line, to sort of respond to what I think you're reacting to, is privacy policies need to be much more user-friendly as to how they describe what the choices are. And I think that when you lump together all that different information with this carve-out and that carve-out, and, you know, here you are a very sophisticated consumer and you can't figure it out. So exactly. The chance that the average subscriber is going to have a tough time and just kind of throw up their hands and give up. So what I take out of that as a privacy lawyer is we privacy lawyers need to do a better job explaining what the choices are and what they apply to.
Right. And again, this is something that if you're a Charter or a Spectrum customer, you might never see, because this is some Time Warner Cable email address that's used here. I do want to mention too, that in finding the links that I featured in this Facebook post here that folks want to do, I'm hoping that you can spend 2 or 3 minutes going through and opting yourself out. Know that it took me 45 minutes or an hour to find all this information, and that doing searches on the website, there's a Time Warner Cable virtual assistant that's supposed to be giving you help. And asking her things like, how do I opt out? Why do I assume she's a she? The virtual assistant, things like, how do I opt out of information sharing or privacy choices, returned no results whatsoever. And same thing for the website in general. If you're searching for opt out or choices or privacy, the support A to Z index has no categories at all for privacy or choices. It does keep encouraging users to download McAfee, though. So that seems to be their answer to all questions relating to privacy and security. So I really was not impressed by the user-friendliness of the Time Warner Cable Charter ecosystem, but I did distill out some links you can follow if you're interested in opting yourself out and you're a customer of one of those companies. Hopefully, they'll accomplish what you want them to accomplish. Next week, I think we'll look at Comcast. or actually next week we're dark. We're not going to be doing a show on April 14th, but we will be back on the 21st with Evan Brown as our guest. And that week we'll look at Comcast. So any thoughts about Comcast between now and then, please send them our way. Not just railing on the company, please, but anything useful we can give people to help themselves be educated about their privacy policies and opt-outs. I would appreciate if you want to get in touch with me or Matt or Mike between the shows about that or anything else. I'm Denise at twit.tv. Matt is Matt C at twit.tv and Mike is Mike at twit.tv. We love to hear from you. You can find us all on Twitter as well. You can find the show's page on Facebook or Google Plus. All great places to get in touch with us. Let us know what's on your mind, what you thought of the show, guests we should invite, topics we should cover. Love hearing from you. So please keep your ideas coming to us. What else should I tell you? We record this show every week at Friday, 11 o'clock Pacific time, 1800 UTC. So if you want to join us live, that's what the time you should put on your calendar. But don't worry about it if it doesn't work for you. Head on over to twit.tv/twill and our whole archive of shows is there for your enjoyment at your leisure. Tanya, really, really great to talk to you again. We really appreciate you taking the time and helping us to understand some of these complicated, dense issues.
Yeah, no, it's been my pleasure. I've been thrilled to be here again, and thanks for having me.
All right, we'll do it again, hopefully in much less time between visits this time around. Great to have you. Anything you want to let folks know about before we sign off today?
No, just, you know, be a good consumer. If you're concerned about consumer privacy and you're a consumer watching this show, read what you can, you know, ask questions when they aren't clear to you and contact the companies you have relationships with to ask questions. And for those of you lawyers who are watching, let's do a better job explaining what those choices are. I think that's a big takeaway today.
Right. And for those of you lawyers and companies that have merged, get your docs together. Make sure there's one uniform set of documents for your customers. Or if there's not, make sure the right customers can find the right documents. And don't leave outdated policies on the web. All very bad practices. Mike, how are you doing? Good to be back in Seattle, I assume.
Yes, very great. I was in Phoenix earlier this week for the Final Four, and then I was in Washington, D.C., just got back yesterday. I was presenting at the ABA Spring IP Conference on copyright. So, yes, great to be back.
And you met Franklin, didn't you? Franklin Graves, former intern of the show.
Yes, Franklin and I, we had a great time.
Very cool.
It was a lot of fun to finally meet him.
Glad you guys got to connect. Looking forward to seeing you again in a couple of weeks.
Likewise. And thank you very much, Tanya, for being with us today. Very educational program. I know I learned a lot.
Oh, you're welcome. Happy to be here.
Yeah, I did too. Matt, great chatting with you again as well.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks, Tanya. The information in the GDPR was really interesting. That's going to certainly be something to follow. So I'm looking forward to learning more about that.
Great. Absolutely. And don't forget, folks, you can find Matt's other podcast at A Pint of Law, lawpint.com. If you just can't get enough of IP-related podcasting, Matt is going to keep on dishing it up for you at Lawpint. So thanks so much, Matt, for joining us. Thank you all for joining us. And we'll see you again in a couple of weeks on This Week in Law. Until then, take care.